All right, ladies, welcome once again to your Venus Index podcast. I'm Brad Howard, and I've got John on the phone once again. We're going to be talking about muscle building, and in particular, talking about muscle building for the different rep ranges and things like that, and what they mean, why they're important or even not important. So, John, I know we've got a lot of questions or a couple of questions in the forums about reps and sets and schemes and things like that, and you know, people just had some questions wondering, you know, if they could switch back to going, you know, light weights and really high reps and, you know, that type of thing. So let's kind of get to the bottom of that and kind of distill it so that people know what they're doing.
Okay, so there's all different, obviously there's different rep ranges and they all have some kind of different effect. They feel different right off the bat. And so we're just going to get into all the differences. So you can, first of all, to affect muscle growth or to have a measurable lasting effect on the muscle, you have to be lifting at some kind of intensity that's above a specific threshold. So some of the research suggests it's above 40% of your one rep max. So that doesn't mean you have to go out and test your one rep max and then make sure all your weights are above 40% of that. All you have to do is imagine just lifting a pencil, like curling a pencil 10 times. Obviously, the pencil is not heavy enough to cause your bicep muscle to get any bigger. You could curl that pencil all day long, nothing's going to happen. But as the pencil gets bigger, you start lifting a glass full of water, then something bigger, then a dumbbell, then a heavier dumbbell. There's going to be a weight that you've crossed a point where not only can you not curl it all day long, but you only can curl it for, you can curl it for 30 reps, then 20 reps, then 10 reps, then it becomes so heavy you can't even move it. Now, on the way up, you're going to be going through various rep ranges that are going to have unique, I guess you could say, effects on what it does to your muscle. So if it's light enough and you can do it for enough reps, basically nothing's going to happen. It might increase the ability for your body to deliver blood to that muscle. That's about it. In fact, if you do enough long-duration, low-intensity exercise, you can theoretically make a muscle smaller. So, for instance, distance runners who are doing a lot of distance running, the body's always moving towards efficiency. So, and in order to deliver oxygen at a greater rate to a muscle in order to just run for a longer distance, your body may actually atrophy the muscle, make the muscle smaller, just because it doesn't need the muscle to be big to do low-intensity, long-duration exercise. And it'll increase the capillary density, meaning the blood vessels that go to that muscle. And so the muscle can be – a high amount of oxygen can be delivered to a small but efficient muscle. Now, that would be sort of on the distance running side. But then that's doing a lot of that kind of exercise. And then you've got the extreme other end where you're doing heavy weights and not necessarily for long duration but for high intensity and with relative frequency, and that would cause the muscle to – be bigger in order to handle the heavy weights. Now that is dependent on testosterone and the amount of testosterone in your bloodstream, which for women it's like 10 times less than men. So you can never actually have muscles as big as a guy because you just don't have the genetic materials to do that. But you can at least build muscles to whatever degree your body can manage. Now somewhere in between those two extremes is where almost all workouts lie. Most people aren't just going to be running 30 kilometers a day, and most people aren't doing maximum lifts every day. So every other workout's somewhere in between. And this gets to what the measurable effects actually are. So are you going to lift – and this is where the concept of program design comes in, and this is why certain rep ranges are used. This is why you fluctuate between higher and lower reps. This is why you don't stay in any one rep range forever. And based on your genetic makeup, you may find one rep range feels a little bit easier or better than another. So that, like, Pilon just likes doing low reps. I like doing slightly higher reps, and then everyone else has, you know, got their own thing. And then the specifics of the rep ranges isn't as important as how it makes you feel. A lot of people just become sort of mentally bored with one rep range, and then they just feel like after a certain number of weeks they want to switch out of that rep range to another. Besides actual muscular adaptations to a given rep range, part of it's just psychological. Some people just don't want to do it anymore. And now there's a Now, there is some difference between men and women when it comes to this sort of thing. It seems as though there's something called a neuromuscular inefficiency in women that isn't expressed in men. Now, this is a bit of a tricky explanation, but imagine that a guy and a girl have the same can do the same number of reps. So they can do 10 reps at 100 pounds on the bench press. And then, but the guy may be able to do one rep at 200 pounds. So his maximum is another 100 pound jump from that 10 rep set. Whereas the girl, her maximum might only be 130 pounds. So she may be only able to jump 30 pounds above what she can do for 10 reps. So there's that gap between what they can do for reps and what they can do as a maximal push. And it seems as though guys can go whatever they can do for an extended number of reps, so 10 or 12 rep set, they have quite a range that they can jump up to for one maximum push. Whereas whatever a woman can do for 10 or 12 reps, it seems as though her maximum is just a little bit higher than that. And that might change how guys and girls perceive or function with various rep ranges. And that's one thing, that's something called a neuromuscular inefficiency, and that's something to do with the female body versus the male body. I don't know if it's a nerve conductance thing, and I don't know how well it's been studied. Also, I don't know too many women who bother pushing maximum weight, so it may just be an artifact that there's just not a lot of women to study in that realm, but the research I've seen suggests that inefficiency exists. And beyond that, that inefficiency, the differences in training at a high rep versus a low rep and the higher and lower intensities for men and women is essentially the same. There's subtle differences like that inefficiency I just mentioned, but in general, a man and woman's body reacts more or less the same to training. So it's not like any program that has to be 100% specifically designed for women versus one that's for guys. Guys and girls can obviously use the same styles of training, and they do. So the changes, the differences in the body themselves is kind of subtle. So getting to the specifics of what rep ranges you even want to train in, that's up to you to some degree if you want to actually go lighter or heavier. There's nothing wrong with that. And I would say more than anything, it's just a mental thing and not to worry so much about the physiology behind it. I am in the middle of putting together the specialization workouts, and they will have somewhat different rep ranges from what you're accustomed to here. It'll look a bit and feel a bit different. So you will be experiencing, whoever wants to pick them up will be experiencing something different from what's in the current workouts. But there's nothing, I guess, to be concerned about, or you're free to like experiment with various rep ranges if you just mentally want to try it out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, it just sounds like that there's really no difference between men and women as far as how you can train. It's just that the response curve is a little bit different.
Yeah, and it's not hugely different. It's slightly different. Like most of the girls I know who compete, they train just like guys. I was actually training with, we'll be interviewing one of the figure models that I know. And me and her were just training the other day, and we actually were testing out some of the new specialization workouts. But, you know, her routine is very similar to what any of the guys in the gym do. Because all you can do with working out is build muscle. I don't know if girls are afraid of that term, but weight training, that's all it can do. You can't reshape a specific muscle. You can reshape your body, but you can't reshape a muscle. And that's because all you can do with the muscles is make it bigger or smaller. But depending on which muscles you focus on, the overall package of muscles, you can actually start reshaping your body. So that's what we mean by shaping. Like, you can't take a muscle and change the length of the muscle belly or change its architecture. It's basically going to be the same shape, just whether or not it's bigger or smaller. And then the only other thing you can do is take the fat off from around that muscle to show it off. So, but most people who've never been lean enough to really see what their muscles, like, they don't know what their muscles look like yet because they've not been lean enough.
Yeah. Let's dig into that a little bit, because I don't think we've covered on this side. What actually determines how you look, how your muscles look, how things hang, and things like that? And where do some of the maybe misconceptions about, you know, shaping a specific muscle, like you're talking about, like actually changing the way that particular muscle looks, where can some of that come from?
Mm-hmm. It's a misinterpretation of just being lean or not, and being and how big or small the muscle is. So the muscle itself, like you and I, when we're lean and put our pictures up, maybe we're not a good example. We look pretty similar from certain angles, like our backs kind of look the same and stuff, and we're about the same height and we're about the same size. But if you see us like standing side by side, it's clear that certain muscles are just shaped differently. Like my traps and your traps look a bit different. Everything just looks a bit different. And that's due to the insertion points are slightly different. So where the muscle actually inserts into the bone, the length of the muscle belly itself, it can be slightly different from person to person. So everyone's going to have a unique look, even with the identical measurements and at the identical height and basically the same body fat. Everybody will have their own look. Everything's shaped just a bit different, and it's due to those things: insertion points, length of muscle belly, even the width of the muscle. It's just everything's just a little different. So you can't assume you'll look exactly like the next person over, even though you could have the same height, muscle size, same body fat, same everything. You're still going to have your own look. Right. I mean, we all look similar. All humans look similar at the same body fat percentage, anyways. But when you, if you just take, even if you stop for like a minute or two and just examine each physique, like when we're judging a contest, everyone on stage looks kind of, you know, they're all in similar shape, but they're clearly just their bodies just clearly have a different look. But then if you took the tape measure to them, you're like, oh yeah, they're all kind of the same measurement, but they all still look very different. So it's just a matter of how the muscles are formed, where they insert, and things like that. And then from there. Now that's comparing like people who are on stage lean, and that's one degree of comparison. For the average person who's not lean enough, you just have no idea what your muscles look like yet because there's too much fat covering them. That's like you got to be pretty lean to really see the shape of your muscles. So I would say towards getting to your ideal VI is when you'll start noticing your shape versus somebody else's shape. But it's still an overall shape. We're not going to be dissecting down to like the actual curves of the division of abs and things like that. That's kind of taking it to another level that mostly just bodybuilders are going to get to.
Yeah. I mean, for example, I mean, some people just have like abs that just line up like in a row.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
like,
yeah.
Like side by side. Mine don't seem to do that. Mine seem to kind of stagger. But there's nothing I will ever be able to do about that.
That's just genetics. And girls shouldn't really be expecting to see abs. That's an abnormally low body fat percentage to actually see a full set of abs.
Right. And the other thing that's kind of goes back into, you know, when you were saying that is that it is literally impossible for you to be somebody else. So kind of going back into comparisons, all you can do, I mean, after listening to this, I mean, let's just reaffirm this fact that all you can do is just be the best you. You can't be anybody else. There's nobody else built just like you.
Yep.
So, I mean, you can have the same rough shape, but, I mean, the best you can do is the best you can do. That's how you're going to look, and it's going to be different. And, you know, like I say, I mean, we've talked about time and time again. All three of us look roughly the same in shirts and stuff. It's funny, we were walking. I remember we were in New York walking around not a seminar, but a trade show. And it was just funny because and actually there was one even in Texas that we were at as well, and Valentine was there. And you guys were sitting in front, and you guys were talking to him, and I was looking at everybody from the back, and you know, you guys were slightly bigger than him, but it wasn't that noticeable. It was really strange.
Oh, in clothes, yeah.
Yeah, in clothes. Mm-hmm. So but yeah, obviously when everybody goes to the pool, I mean, we've got pictures up of, you know, me hanging out with Pilon in the pool, and we look totally different.
Yeah, but in clothes, it's relatively the same. I think that's going to be slightly different for girls because girls wear different styles of clothes. But,
sure.
Yeah, and this speaks to that clothes on versus Well, for guys, we say shirt on, shirt off. Shirt on big versus shirt off big. For girls, I guess we could say clothes on versus bikini.
Yeah.
Definition or size or
lights on or lights off.
Yeah, lights on or lights off. Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
So, yeah, so the degree you want to take your look and your body is depends on what you're after. And again, this we've already talked about this as a potential sabotage point being the look you have in your clothes versus the look you have without clothes. And it makes a difference. It makes quite a big difference because you can fluctuate. You can get really close to your numbers and it's indistinguishable in clothes if you can, like, what else is going on. And then it's just you in the mirror when you're not wearing any clothes. You're like, oh yeah, I still got more to go. And that's like, and that will be the end of the contest. That will be that time. And I think somebody in the forum brought up the concept of the last 10 pounds and she was, I got to start writing this down so I remember everyone's name. She was mentioning that she kind of thought it was neat that she recognized or had the epiphany that, oh my, I'm actually in the last 10 pounds. And that's a big deal, recognizing that that's where you are, just because the changes are slightly different when you don't have much left to go. And a few people have contacted me about that and like are getting close and are wondering what to do next. And those are total normal reactions because that's a good thing. It's almost like you kind of want to get to the point where you're not sure because you're so close. Obviously. I mean, when you've got 50 pounds to go, it's obvious you have 50 pounds to go. But when you're getting close and you're wondering, oh man, what do I do now? That's a good uneasiness to be at because it means you're closing in on it. And even figure competitors, unless you've been through it once or twice before, it seems a bit, you're not actually sure how far you have to go. And so most people who do a figure show or fitness competitor, even bodybuilders, anybody, guys and girls, the first time they do a show, you're not really like, you don't know if the show's 2 weeks away, you don't actually know if you physically are ready, if you're actually 2 weeks away yourself. All you know is, well, I'm competing in 2 weeks no matter what I look like. And that's what we've got going on here. For anyone who's going to be entering, who's never done a transformation before, like Kat, she's done one before that I can think of off the top. So she kind of knows where she's at. Now, depending on she wants to get to a look she's had before or she wants to go past that, she might be getting into uncharted territory. And some of you who maybe have been in a competition before, maybe been in certain shape for sports or something, you might be have an idea of where you're at. But for most people, it seems as though this is all kind of new. So if what do we have 50 days left, you might not know if you're only 40 days away or if you're 60 days away or what you are. So all you know is there's 50 days to do as best as I can do in the next 50 days. And that's the only way you can view it. And so it is a bit of walking around in the dark, but that's okay because the whole point is to just get as far as you can in the next 50 days and then from there assess what you want to do next. Some people are just going to want to jump right into the next competition. Some people are going to want to just maintain. Everyone's going to have their thing. But the point is to just continually move forward. And if this is your first time, that's just how it has to be. Everyone's first time at this, it of course is just a walk in the dark. Like how are you supposed to know if you've never been there before? Like anyone I've ever worked with on their first competition, same thing. I mean, what you do is you gather information from other people and you're like, well, what should I expect? What can I do? And that's kind of what everyone's doing. But until you finally go through it, you're always going to be slightly unsure, but that's fine to be unsure because until you're two competitions in, how could you possibly be sure? So you gotta be, don't even expect to be 100% sure unless you've done it before. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a comforting thing or not, but it's okay to be unsure, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where at the beginning when people are really trying to, you know, get a handle on this, it feels like it takes a while for people to gain some momentum and get some things, but then they get their life kind of in some structure that they can work with. But then once that happens, things seem to take off, right? And things seem to speed up. Results seem to come a lot faster. But then you hit a spot where the results slow down. And it's not that you're doing anything wrong, right? But it's you're at that point where things slow down, and it's just that's the way it is, and it's tough. I mean, trust me. I know it happens in lots of other things other than this, but it's tough. I mean, it happens in muscle building as well. You know, where, you know, you're sitting there, you're doing everything right. You think you're plateaued. You think you need to switch things up, but it just might be that you're just at that point where it gets to be the grind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's expected. But that's that the other thing about that. And John and I were talking about this the other day. Revisiting the whole concept of a sabotage point. If it's your first time doing this, everything beyond what you think your sabotage point is a sabotage point. Like every step beyond that point is a sabotage point because it's uncharted territory. Like every step beyond that, there's a little voice in your head that says, this is good enough. This is good enough, right? And so you should just have to be aware of that. It's not necessarily a sabotage point as much as it is everything after that is.
It's uncharted waters. And it's,
yeah.
And it's like, and I, that was funny. Yeah. That was really interesting. You brought that up a couple of days ago. I'm glad you said that just now. It could be, you could view any new measurement as a new sabotage point. You could be like, so you could just pick in your head what you think. Because you've never seen any of these things before, so you could find a new number that, let's say, you just stagnate at a new number for a week. You're like, oh, that's my new sabotage point, or a new measurement, a new number on the scale, a new weight in the gym. You might hit your limit on how much training and cardio you can do in a week. You could just find any number of reasons why, since it's all new, you won't. It's all kind of. You just don't allow it to trick you into thinking it stops. You can get as far as you want. You just have to keep pushing. And that doesn't sound very technical or anything, but that's all there is to it. It's accepting the fact that feedback might come in a bit slower. So the scale may slow down. It may not change as much. You may have to trust the way like that clothes are fitting differently. Think, you know, like I know I was just reading a post about, God, I got to remember everyone's name. Well, I know everyone's name. I just can't remember which post it was. So I'm sure you guys are hearing me speak about you specifically. But from now on, I think I'll try to make little notes on who said what. Someone was mentioning that their pants are fitting differently in the legs. So if the scale didn't necessarily change, they know for sure that pants are fitting differently. So all of those things are – it's almost like you got to key in on more subtle changes towards the end. Or even just along the way, the initial big changes, especially in weight loss due to some water loss and inflammation coming down. Once that goes away, and you kind of have gotten rid of that, and you're living in, I guess, a less bloated or less inflamed, or just carrying less water on a day-to-day basis. Now that once that starts to fade, like that big drop is gone, the true fat loss drops might be a bit slower. So you have to kind of readjust your feedback. I mean, it's pretty a lot of this has to do with biofeedback. So this is a concept we use when we build supplements or make anything in this industry. So, I mean, we can talk about biofeedback another time. But in general, it's the concept of you have something feeding back and telling you something's happening. So stepping on the scale, that's biofeedback. You see a number. Measuring yourself, that's some biofeedback. Like measurements, that's some biofeedback. Even for supplements, just tasting it, like when we make a protein powder, the actual taste of the protein, that's biofeedback. You can taste it. So these are like indicators that something's happening. So when you take an anti-inflammatory, you have a headache, you take something or a painkiller, and then a half an hour later your headache's gone. That's biofeedback. You know something happened. So when you're trying to change the look and shape of your body, you may go from a state of higher biofeedback to lower biofeedback. And if you're used to seeing the scale change every couple of days and you're used to the tape measure changing drastically every week and you're used to the weights changing in the gym, you're just used to a lot of stuff happening that can keep you motivated a lot because there's quite a bit going on. There's all of these indicators that progress is happening. But towards the end, if progress – it's happening but at a lower rate or a more subtle rate, you have to refocus on that and recognize the biofeedback's still there, but it's smaller. So maybe the scale doesn't change as big, or maybe the tape measure doesn't change as big, or maybe it's more the subtle look you have in the mirror. You're like, oh yeah, I'm a bit leaner, or certain, maybe not all your clothes fit differently, but certain articles of clothes start to fit differently, like ones that hadn't changed yet. So there's, you have to kind of pay attention to more things along the way, purely just to keep on track. Cause, you know, we kind of want to believe that there is something changing. It's kind of hard to just go on total blind faith, just assuming something's happening without being able to measure it. And again, being able to measure on a day-to-day basis would be amazing. It's just kind of really hard to do that. And I think that's part of the reason why the workouts are so important, is that's immediate biofeedback. Like, you go to the gym, you feel it. You feel every rep. You feel yourself getting stronger. You remember what the workout felt like last time, and you can categorize in your head that, oh, I'm better at this time, or this is certain thing is improving, this number, but this particular exercise feels better. You can just tell, right? Just your connection, your mind-muscle connection, your connection to how good you are at contracting a particular muscle, how good your form is on a particular exercise. There's so much biofeedback with a workout. But on the diet side, it's hard. Your biofeedback is your ability to not eat that much. So progress on the diet side involves less biofeedback, not more. Unless you're doing some fasting where the fast itself has biofeedback literally by the hour. You can kind of think in your head, oh yeah, at the 18 hour mark, I normally feel one way, and at the 20 hour mark, I kind of feel a different way. I think that's part of the magic of the fasting, is that it's one of the only diets that has built-in biofeedback, whereas most diets try to clutter you up with all kinds of things to do, when really the biofeedback is just experiencing and getting through the feelings of not eating as much. So there's kind of – you have to understand that the diet side will never produce the biofeedback that the workout side produces.
Well, at least not the positive.
You could
feel hungry.
And then so that, I mean, I just wrote a blog post about this on my blog about how exercise affects diet. I think doing something every day is absolutely critical, doing some kind of physical activity. So if you're just doing 3 VI workouts a week, the other 4 days you got to do something to get that positive biofeedback. Even if it's just a 20-minute walk, that biofeedback – not even the calories burned from the walk, nothing beside the biofeedback from the walk, the feeling of being connected to your body again and getting up and moving, that's more important, I think, than anything else, or that trumps sort of everything else. So if you can constantly just do something. Somebody was mentioning taking a break but still going to the gym. Here I go again with the somebodies. Trust me, I know everyone's name. I just can't remember who said what. Was saying that even if you're going to take a break, go to the gym and just do something a lot lower impact. Just do yoga or stretching or something. Sit in the sauna, just hang out in the pool. Just do something to be in the routine, even just the routine of going to the gym. Like, that's all important too, right? So a lot of this has to do with routine, and a lot of this has to do with biofeedback. And I don't know if that's a new thing to you, but if the biofeedback is – stop and think if that's maybe something that you've been missing on some days, is that biofeedback from exercise. And I'll bet any money it correlates to your bad eating days, is if you didn't have a good workout day, or didn't work out at all, or didn't even engage in some kind of physical activity. And I'll bet you any money those days overlap quite a bit, meaning the days where you fell off the diet wagon and the days where you also didn't train or didn't get any biofeedback from moving your body.
Yeah. I mean, for myself, I do that. I mean, right now, I'm doing the same thing. I only really lift, I would say, 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems now it's Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been Mondays and Wednesdays and Fridays and Sundays. I just go for a walk. You know, if I'm feeling okay, maybe I'll do some light stuff, you know, for shoulders just to warm up, or maybe I'll do I stretch out a little bit because my low back just seems to be tight right now for some reason. So I'm just working around that, and just kind of, it almost sounds weird, but almost taking it easy from beating myself up so much, because, you know, obviously we've been training pretty good for the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. You know, on this stuff, testing out new things, and you know, I'm kind of to the point where even mentally just need a break. You know, things slow down. And so At best, the way I'm thinking about it, or not at best, but the way I'm thinking about it right now is I just want to maintain where I kind of recuperate at the same time, still lift, you know, enough to sustain what I have and still lift pretty heavy on those days. But just coming to the point where I'm not trying to grow. I'm just trying to, you know, maintain and keep the routine going until I feel a little bit fresher and feel a little bit better. And I'm already feeling better.
Yeah, you pick your spots. Like, I'm expecting everyone to push hard for the next however many weeks are left in the contest, and then probably back off for 3 or 4 weeks, and then doing what you're doing right now, back off, kind of allow the system to recharge or reset, so to speak, until you're ready for the next intense push. Allie said the same thing during her last sort of before her pictures as she got ready for that photo shoot. Things ramped up and became more intense and more intense and more intense, and then she just needed a break. And she didn't. But the key is you don't just stop everything. You just scale back the intensity. Like Brad just said, you scale it back to, you know, 4 days of walking, 3 days of training instead of 6 days of intense something. So, which was what Allie was doing. It got up pretty intense for the last, you know, maybe 24 days. And then that just, you know, your system can only handle so much. I mean, we're not pro athletes or Olympic athletes where this is all we do is train and sleep. We actually have other responsibilities. So the system has a limit of stress it can handle until it breaks. So over the next 50 days, you should be testing your limits, so to speak, over the next 50 days. That's kind of the point of this. You can't expect dramatic changes without dramatic effort. That goes without saying. Anyone who's marketing the fact that, there's a secret trick to getting huge changes without serious effort, is just playing you for a sucker. Big changes come with big effort but they're rewarding at the end. And some of that effort is just controlling the diet. I mean, that doesn't require you to lift anything or to sweat or any, it just requires kind of a emotional and mental effort. You could even say social effort, I guess, on the diet side. So, it's kind of like however much you want to put into it, it's how much you get out of it. And that's that. I've never met anyone who's gotten great shape who didn't say it was a lot of effort. That's a hard thing to sell, but I mean, at least we're guiding you to the most efficient way to spend your effort. A lot of other people will be sending you on a wild goose chase on carb cycling and just all over the place, you know, cutting certain calories out and having days where you only drink protein shakes and other days. It's just all of that nonsense. And that's even – it's going to take tons of effort anyways. It'd be just ridiculous that people can try to make it even more difficult than it's already going to be. So what we're trying to do is minimize the amount of wasted effort.
Yeah. I was thinking about this the other day, and, you know, you follow me for a second while I kind of explain this. But we understand where you're at. And we understand our challenges talking to you and explaining a lot of this, especially in this type of transformation, especially kind of going back to hot states and just some of the stuff John was talking about, how difficult it really is, even without making it even more difficult on yourself. A lot of you have kids, and one of these days, if you haven't already, you're going to have that sex conversation, and you're going to be telling your kid, and I don't have kids, but I'm just kind of thinking through this. You're going to be talking to your kid and telling them all the ways either to abstain from having sex or how to protect themselves from having sex and all of this other stuff, right? But we all know it's easy to say those things, but when you get put in that moment and it's time to make those decisions where you have that type of stimulus in front of you, right? It's very difficult to, you know, no matter how much training you have, to you know, make a good decision in some of those instances. This is kind of the same thing. It's a really high, you know, when you start talking about hunger and your ego and things like that, and piling on more and more and more stuff, you know, it starts to become more difficult because you already have the underlying stimulus under you that's hard enough to resist as it is, right? Does that make sense? I mean, or am I just way out in left field?
No, it's just it's I mean, it's something that you know you got to do, but you just keep putting it off.
Yeah, I'm just trying to connect the same type of thing, like that frustration that you as a parent may have with a kid, with this particular conversation, you know, and you're trying to keep your kids from having children early and things like that, is the same. It's kind of the same thing, you know, that we're talking about with you and trying to change your body, and the same type of powerful stimulus that you have to overcome is the same one that they're going to have to overcome.
Right? Oh yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? It's a different twist on it. You know, it's
omnipresent. It's always there.
Right, exactly. I mean, so it'd be like, let's just be funny about it. Let's say for a guy, there's a guy, and then there's a hot woman, and he's resisting, and then all of a sudden you throw in two other hot women.
Okay, you really think?
But
you really think they're
going
to be relating to this right now?
I don't know. I was just thinking about it the other day, and
I relate to it.
You know, but how hard would that be? It's kind of like, okay, we already know it's going to be hard enough for you to eat less, but now what we're going to do is we're going to throw on the fact that you can only work out in the mornings at 7 a.m. That's the only time it ever works.
Oh, okay, and I see. You're talking about other fitness marketers that just make it just ridiculously complex.
Well, not even marketers themselves, but just anything that
just the dogma, yeah, all that extra stuff.
Yeah. You just start adding more and more stuff to an already really hard situation.
Oh, eating less right off the bat's monumentally difficult. It's like the hardest thing you can possibly try to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think the workouts are just it helps that a lot, because it gives you, like I said, the biofeedback, something to do to not eat. At least you're working out instead of eating. So, I mean, that's at least one thing to do. Plus, it keeps you on track. It keeps you in touch with your body, all that kind of stuff. So you can theoretically diet down without lifting a weight or doing anything. It's just really difficult. It's that whole all or nothing thing that happens when people stop, when people don't work out on a given day. It's kind of like that not working out begets also not paying attention to your diet. So it's just like the floodgates are open on the day that you don't work out. And I know that happens, and it's worse when it's a planned workout day that gets canceled for some reason. So if tomorrow is just a planned day off of training, and maybe all we do is go for a walk, that day is not so dangerous to fall off the diet wagon. But if tomorrow is a planned workout day and things just get in the way and you somehow don't get to your workout, that's the danger day, where it also seems to be, well, now that the workout's ruined, I might as well just go down on an entire pizza. Like it's those are the day, and that happens to just about everybody I know. Like when their workout day gets ruined somehow, it's almost like you go into a little mini spiral on that day, and also decide to sabotage your diet just because the workout half was taken away somehow. And I think it's the expectation that you were going to work out and then it got taken away is the real issue on those type of days, versus a day where you weren't planning on working out anyways. And it's weird because it shouldn't matter. Like, it shouldn't at all. One shouldn't at all affect the other, but it really does. Psychologically, it does. Physically, it makes no difference. But so I think it's the biofeedback and that feeling of moving forward. So if you don't get to do your workout, that day just doesn't feel like a positive, like when we were talking positive, neutral, and backwards days. You already feel like it's a backwards day just because the workout itself got missed. And even though it's not a backwards day, it might feel that way just because the workout, you were hoping for it, and then it got taken away from you. So now you're sort of, even though nothing's moving backwards, it might feel that way. And then that kind of has that, well, the day's already ruined feeling, and then you just go ahead and kind of fall off the wagon on the diet side too. So you got to be aware of that stuff. And again, that, I guess the take home message is be active every single day. And if you currently aren't, start that like today, start that right now. And if you are, that's good, and continue that. And be very aware that on any day when you like let the entire day go by without at least going for a walk or something, you're putting yourself at risk for taking a backward step, and test that out and see how that feels. And it doesn't need to be interval training or anything intense. It can easily be, you know, the VI workouts plus walking every other day. But it's important. It's definitely important. And again, that's up to you where you want to fit that into your day.
Yeah, I mean, makes sense to me. So, yeah, we kind of went around the block a little bit on this one, which is fine.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, we do that from time to time.
All right, you got anything else?
Nah, I don't think so. I think I got enough analogies done for the day.
So maybe
for the year. But,
for the year. Yeah. And so we are on track to have the specializations done for the 1st.
Yeah, March 1st. So they should be live, and you guys can pick them up. I'm pretty excited to get them in.
I was testing a couple out last night, and I'm pretty sore from it.
Oh, you wimp.
Well,
they're girls' workouts, man.
Hey, girls are supposed to work out just like guys. Don't let anybody tell you different. It's
All right.
Actually, man. I tested out the butt one yesterday.
Oh Lord.
Yeah. So I think a few of the guys in the gym were wondering what the hell I was doing.
Oh God.
Well, just because like guys don't focus on that muscle group.
I'm about to cry.
Whatever. At least I had girls with me testing it with me.
The Barb and Booty Blaster.
Yeah, that's basically what it was.
It's the BBB.
The triple B.
That's great.
B cubed.
Oh shit.
Man. All right. That's enough.
All right. Well, for John Barber, I'm Brad Howard, and that's your Venus and Nix podcast.